think about working with the energy in your body to assist in your own healing? Have you explored this in your own life? Or maybe you've been a skeptic, but life event has caused you to maybe even wonder about energy healing, or you've tried it, maybe it's worked. I've had a chronic illness for the past, 15 years or so. So I've definitely explored energy in some ways, acupuncture. I've even done some meditation where I've called in white light into my system to see if that's going to do anything. And I don't know, maybe it has worked. I'm not really sure exactly, because that relationship with outcome and cause is always at times tenuous. Well, here to wonder with us about energy is a man of science who has himself lived a life that has also caused him to wonder about the healing world that exists a little bit outside the parameters of what we can prove. Dr. David Hoxley, sorry about that, David, is a lecturer at the Department of Chemistry and Physics at La Trobe University. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you for inviting me. It's great to be here.
I love talking to a physicist because I don't understand anything. Can you just even, let's kick off in the most basic way we can. For you as a scientist, what's energy?
For me as a physicist, energy is about motion and about things making other things move. So when I think about energy in the body, I immediately think about heat and temperature, and then I start to think about chemical energy and the way that different molecules can pass their energy towards each other, between each other, but only if the lock and the key are just right. And I guess that's when I think about people who are trying to use energy to create some sort of resonance in themselves. The key is that resonance. We can crawl inside a microwave and become very uncomfortable very quickly when it's turned on, but we can also be exposed to other sorts of microwaves that pass straight through us.
It's interesting to hear a physicist talk about resonance. How do you mean resonance?
I mean resonance in so many ways. For a physicist, that's one of the most exciting parts of any system. So I'm a bit of a shower singer. So you know how there's some notes that are always louder than others? You know, that's because the dimensions of the box that you're singing in happen to match the length of the waves that you're producing with your mouth. It's like when you blow over the top of a beer bottle and then drink a bit more beer and then blow over the top of it again, and they're all that's the Helmholtz resonator. And the same happens when ultraviolet light hits your skin and causes biological changes. That's because the wavelength of the light is matched to the properties of the molecules that it's hitting, and then it can damage them in bad ways. So, yes, we definitely live in harmonic oscillators and resonance. This is the language of our day-to-day life.
And so then the difference potentially through a physicist's perspective around resonance and a natural healer around that resonance is how we influence it. So whilst I might hum in my body and change the vibration and therefore change my health, you would think about the shifting of resonance differently, would you?
A little bit. I mean, we tend to think about to start with, we'll always take a good placebo. I think that any scientist would be happy to say that if even if it doesn't have a physical change, then you're very happy to allow your emotional well-being to be uplifted, even through the perception that it's changed.
See, placebo is such an interesting thing, isn't it? Because does it not prove potentially that if we're taking a placebo when we have an increase in health, that we have a capacity to change our well-being through mental shifts of our energy?
I agree. And I think that gets back to the question you're really asking, which is how can we find these resonances? How do we know if we've found them? What does a resonance feel like when you've got it? I mean, on a cellular level, you're not going to feel it very much. And I think that if we are seeking those sorts of resonances, then when we find them, might find a lift in well-being. That's not to say that we have found a magic vibration that will allow our body to straighten itself out and cure, say, cancer that's inside it. So I think that we've got to make the distinction.
Even getting to talk to you about vibration in that way and, this kind of concept feels like we're crossing into so many different worlds. For you yourself, though, you have had some challenging experiences with health in your life that
That's right.
have kind of had you really wonder about this world that sits outside exactly what we can prove happens.
Certainly. So I would say that there are no atheists in a foxhole. I think that when, so I've had cancer, I was diagnosed with multiple myeloma when I was 31, which is relatively young, not a great prognosis for that particular disease, but I was lucky to have one of the greatest hematologists on the face of the planet, thanks Tony Schwarr at the Alfred, and I'm now officially cured, which is fantastic. But my son also was diagnosed with leukemia years ago, and that's a very similar treatment. And so you find yourself asking all the time, what have I done wrong? How do I fix it? Am I to blame? Is there a way that I can somehow make everything right in whatever it takes? And so you start looking through all the different possibilities. And as a physicist and as a scientist, I'm naturally quite skeptical. I want to see proof. And when you go through and look at all of the different possibilities, you say, look, if it can lead to an uplift in mood and perception, then there's something going on there that will work. But in itself, no. Do power lines cause cancer? No.
You can look at me and you can say that definitively, that there is no...
Yes, it's getting back to what your previous interviewee was talking about with the difference between causation and correlation. People who are less wealthy tend to get cancer more often, and rich people don't tend to live near power lines. And so when you correct the studies that seem to have hinted towards that, these cancer maps in the UK famously in the 70s and 80s that had these kind of red blotches where lots of people who were living near power lines got cancer, when you go through them and you correct them, the correlation is not statistically significant. Even though you might think on the face of it, you're next to this great big buzzing source of energy. There's so much power goes through those wires. And if you stand there with the right measuring instrument, you can see that there's a lot of electromagnetic radiation coming from them. But it doesn't resonate with us. We're not tuned to it. We're not an antenna for that. There are antennas for it. That's what your mobile phone does. But it's carefully selected so that they're not the wavelengths that are going to hurt us.
So you're going through a very challenging experience with your health, and then I can't even imagine what the experience must have been when you went through that with your child. You said you wondered and explored things. What did you do?
I'm very keen on music. Music's a big thing for me. And the first thing I did, to the slight horror of the nurses in the Royal Children's, was I brought in a stereo to my son's room. And again, I, as Funkadelic said in one of their famous songs, the funk can only move, it can remove, dig. So
I just want to sit in that moment for a little bit. That's hilarious.
So I do believe in the healing power of music and the healing power of dance. And again, I don't believe that it is necessarily literally the vibrations of the sound waves making my body cavities somehow energized. I think if I want to energize a body cavity, then I'll drink a cup of tea. But there is something about the psychological lift that you get when you feel that you're somehow in harmony with your surroundings. And I think that's a psychological parallel to the concept of resonance that works for me very much. You know, is the system that I am as part of the world that I'm in harmony with itself? It doesn't have to be still, but is it moving in a way where it's somehow ringing? You know, is it ringing like a bell? Do I feel happy and shining? Or does it feel like I'm just sort of slightly out of sync with a skipping rope?
That's so interesting then, isn't it, then? Because we are talking about perception. So how we perceive ourselves in the world has a true impact then on how we are.
I totally believe that.
How do we explain that scientifically?
That's something I want to be cautious about as a physicist. The graveyard of ideas is littered with physicists who spoke too strongly about economics and race and so forth. But the psychosomatic positive effects of the healing process, I think, is well documented. And my friends who are doctors often say, yes, absolutely, it matters. If you want to heal,
it's so denigrated, though, isn't it, in a way, that if a placebo or the placebo effect or the psychosomatic impacts, it feels like it's all in your mind. But in fact, it is, and in fact, it has a capacity to change.
It is denigrated sometimes, especially when people have a platform or a barrier to push. But if you're sitting down over a glass of red wine, it always seems to be red wine, with a doctor who's, you know, working with dozens of patients a day, they will talk about this as being incredibly important. If you're a cardiologist and you're talking about people's heart fitness, then their motivation to exercise and eat well, if the motivation for people to take their medications, for example, that can be enough.
Because that's the next step, isn't it, when we're looking at causation and correlation. When you are thinking differently, your behaviour is different. It's not simply the thinking, perhaps. It's about the behaviour that the thinking instigates. When you're thinking well, you'll take your medication. When you're thinking well, you'll do behaviours and be exercising potentially to improve fitness. So it is interesting then too to think about that those stages.
I totally agree. I think you need to look at the system as a whole, and that's something that physicists, I think, do a lot of. We say, okay, what are the boundaries of our system, and how does the system, how do the different parts of the system work together? And so I think that's why physicists are often comfortable being occasionally quite almost mystical sounding when we talk about quantum mechanics or special relativity or the God particle or whatever it is that Stephen Hawking's talking about this week. We're quite comfortable thinking big and thinking about large systems or very, very, very small systems. We're also quite comfortable with realizing that our models aren't reality.
Explain that.
The analogies that we use aren't actually true. So I might talk about the atom as being some electrons, little lumps doing laps around a nucleus. But that's only a model that works for some situations. In other situations, you have to think about it as being this kind of smeared out kind of egg model where nothing's particularly localized and you can only look at probabilities. And the ability to switch between these two different mental constructs is something that physicists do all the time. And we change our minds all the time too. We're quite promiscuous about that. And I think that's something that people often find it disconcerting about the way physicists talk, is that we'll happily move from one analogy to another. The universe is a rubber sheet in 1 minute and then it's a box in the next. But I think if you can move between those modalities, you get a lot of power by being flexible, and you can the sum becomes much greater than the bit of the parts.
When we think about science, and I think science specifically, though, we do think about skepticism, but your openness to launch into aspects of our living that we don't know with a belief as well. Is that required? Or a belief's not the right word, but it's an interesting idea.
Absolutely. So I've got a really good friend, probably my best mate, did a PhD in cultural studies looking at people who have had an experience where they feel that they've been abducted by aliens. Now, this is not something that you would normally do a PhD in, but it's a very interesting system to look at the way that people respond to the sublime in a kind of post-religious environment. And he and I have been to meetings of the UFO Society and so forth. And both of us are the sort of scientists that would say, look, if we meet an alien, awesome. Show us one and we'll
but
change our mind.
But you need to see the alien.
That's right.
You need to have an experience of that alien. It's interesting, isn't it? Is it similar to the near-death experience? I mean, do you have much to do with that sort of phenomena or the idea around that? Because that's largely about people's perception of energy, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, I'm fascinated by the way that people who have come out of comas or these near-death experiences always seem to talk about light and moving towards a kind of a white light. But I don't know what to make of that. There's nothing I can sink my teeth into as a physicist there, apart from the idea that your sense data become much flatter when you're almost dead.
Are you having to, though, explain it in the understanding of the world you have now, therefore potentially diminishing your capacity to really understand it? Or is there a way to open up into the possibility so that you can maybe find a new pathway to understand these sorts of things?
That's a really nice question, because we, as like sacks of salty water called human beings.
Look at you and your analogies. Am I a rubber mat or a sack of salty
that's
water?
That's right. Well, I'm doing some work with a very sensitive instrument at the moment, and you've got to be out of the room or else it picks you up like some sort of thing. Anyway, I think that I've forgotten the question.
Oh, it was about whether you as a scientist are you always living in what you know, or do you have to sometimes flip out of that?
That's right. So I think physicists are really good at saying, okay, we seem to be looking for 11 dimensions as to explain the universe. What does it mean to be in 11
dimensions?
Are
we looking for 11? How many are we living in that we know about?
Well, this is as monkeys, we're living in three.
We're three.
Maybe four if you include time.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can sort of draw time versus space. So three, space, one, time. That's what special relativity does. But most theorists are fairly comfortable with 11. You can have countably and incountably infinite dimensions if you want in a Hilbert space. I've got to be countable for a Hilbert space. But we will invent mathematical language that will allow us to construct ways of thinking that we can't as ourselves naturally. So we leave our intuition behind and we construct a special language to do so. So that kind of Siamese twin argy-bargy between mathematics and physics that's been going on for a couple hundred years is where the physicists pull the mathematicians to invent languages that we can use to describe what we can't. And that way we can approach maybe the sublime in that way because we've invented a language and most of the languages we find work for us are mathematics. Now, there are some people for whom that language might be music, it might be prayer, it might be dance. It might even be fashion. So, you know, I think there's lots of different vocabularies that you need to invent in order to think about something that you can't think. So physicists will... There's a Dance Your PhD competition run every single year by Nature magazine.
That's
and Australians
right.
are very good at winning it. You know, we're very, very good at grabbing hold of new things if we think that there's something at the end of it.
Because your religion is music, how did Funkadelic go in that hospital room with your son?
Actually... My son wasn't massively into Funkadelic. He, at the time, although he was only four, he was very much into Motorhead and 1970s era metal, which
they love it at this age.
Right, it's not just
me. I've got a kid who loves the King Gizzard. Yeah. Anyway, continue.
Yeah.
So it was using, and did music work?
It relaxed me.
Yeah.
And that's what I think made the difference. It took me a while to get...
Motorhead relaxed you?
Yeah. Well, the fact that, number one...
Ace of Spades?
Absolutely. Actually... Capricorn was the one that we both liked, but the fact that we were relaxed, that I was relaxed meant he was relaxed meant everyone was relaxed, and
yeah.
I felt like I was doing something and I wasn't doing any harm. I think that's the thing. First, do no harm.